I really like context. Sometimes I like it more than actually the verse in the Bible. I've been looking at some context about Jesus at the moment. It's quite cool. So if we can go to the next pic, please. It's seizing. Okay, it's a... it'll be the map. Map of Israel. Anyway, so a bit of context. Yay, a bit of context. Under King David, Israel's all united. So this whole area from down here to up here somewhere, it's all one kingdom. They are at war with everyone around them. They're always fighting. Okay, David dies. Solomon comes in, his son. The whole nation's at peace. It's all still united. They become very financially prosperous. They're doing really well. David and Solomon are both very, very pro-God. Then Solomon ends up as a bit of a pants man, if you know what I mean, as kids here. And the kingdom starts to fall apart. And so after Solomon, from then onwards, the kingdom split in two. So we've got Israel above, Judah down below. A couple of generations before, they've been brought in this land by Moses. You know, they've all been working together. Now they're trying to kill each other. And everyone around them is trying to kill them. So it's a kind of a hotbed of war. I was just reading here, they routinely get the bash by their neighbors. Every time God gets angry with them, they get the bash. And their kings have gone from bad to worse. So almost all of them have turned to other gods, especially the northern kingdom of Israel. And they're rapidly losing all connection to their history, and they're turning away from the ways of their fathers, which is pretty much what we see today. You know, the sort of the Judeo-Christian ethic is kind of getting turned against. And so I guess from one perspective, we can identify with what Elijah is seeing. He's pro-God, and he's watching his whole nation turning away. So at the time of Elijah, the current king of Israel has married a princess from Sidon, which is there. They traditionally bashed them, so he thought, well, I'm going to marry her. That should hopefully stop the attack from the north, at least. I'll just fight with the guys in the south. She happens to be a priestess of the god Baal? Don't know how to pronounce it. But she actually imports, they think, up to 1,000 priests when she comes across to live in Israel to try and help spread her religion. So we've got this major invasion of a different religion right at the top from the king. And just to illustrate how far off the track they've already got, the verse before we're introduced to Elijah, we are introduced to a guy called Heel, who's just rebuilt Jericho. If we can have the next picture. Okay, now that's Sidon. Doesn't look so bad. She was probably a pretty princess. Okay, next one. Okay, there's Jericho. So do you remember they all walked around Jericho until the walls fell down? So it was all of Israel combined together to get rid of that place. Now, a couple of generations later, this guy Heel decides to rebuild it. And when it came down, Joshua pronounced a curse on anyone who tried to rebuild it. Because it was such an image of what they'd conquered. And then a couple of generations later, someone's like, this is a great city, I'm going to rebuild it. So, you know, they've completely lost track of where they've come from. Okay, so Elijah appears on the scene. Sorry if I'm going fast. He appears on the scene when it's not super cool to be a prophet of God, and society's largely turning away from the silliness of their old religion. And the current flavor is obviously Baal, and Baal is the god of storms, rain, and dew. Can we get the next image? Remember that now. Two or three parents will understand what's going on there. Okay. If you've got tweens. Okay, I'm just going to paraphrase here. So we're talking, I think the next one, 1 Kings 17, verse 17, I think. Now Elijah the Tishbite, so he's from, I'll show you later on. He's fairly close to where the king's palace is. God basically sends him to Ahab, the current king, and tells him there will be neither dew nor rain for the next few years, except at my word. Okay, and obviously Baal is the god of dew and rain, right? So this is a direct attack on Baal's sovereignty. Right, can we grab the next page? Then God says to Elijah, after he said this to the king, "Now, whoa, we've stirred up the hornet's nest, let's get out of here." So he sends him off, you know, go find a ravine. Can we grab the next picture? This is the ravine they think he went to because it's the closest to where he lived. And then you can see the caves up in the mountains there and stuff. So he has to head off into this ravine, and then God says, you know, don't worry, I'm going to look after you. And then he gets fed by airmail. He gets the ravens bring him the food. And unfortunately for Elijah, ravens eat carrion, which makes them unclean. So he's sitting in a cave in a little valley by himself. There's famine going on, and he's eating unclean bird food. Where have we got? Okay, so now Jezebel, once this famine starts, Jezebel, which is the princess that Ahab married, she realizes that he's actually messed with her God's legitimacy, and probably the best idea is to just kill all of the people that believe in that. So she goes around murdering all the priests and prophets, and we're told that only about 100 survive, and they all end up in caves like Elijah was doing. So things are really, really hot for Elijah. He needs to be careful. So God moves him up to Sidon, which is where Jezebel came from in the first place. And he lives there with a Gentile widow and her son. And again, they're unclean, so he's not even supposed to be in their house. But there's that sense that God is with him and God's looking after him, even though he's in the wrong situations. God is feeding him. God's making, you know, her, if you remember the story, her bottle of oil won't run out. So they're living through this famine where everyone else is dying around them, and they've got this nonstop, you know, favor from God. So although at the time these are probably two low points, you know, living in this ravine, you know, God's kind of messed his life. Like he was probably having a pretty cool life, and then God said, go talk to Ahab. But in retrospect, these are high points where God is actually just sustaining him through these awful times. Plus he gets to resurrect a dead kid, which probably was pretty cool. So then on to 1 Kings chapter 18. God tells tells Elijah 3 years later, okay, you head back to Ahab now. Let's end this drought. Let's end this famine. So he heads back down from Sidon. Don't have time to probably read this, but I really like he's going back and he meets one of Ahab the king's top henchmen, and he says to this guy, well, go tell Ahab that I'm on my way. And the guy says, no, I'm not going to go. I'm not going because I know that you prophets of God get carried around. God picks you up and carries you away. And I love it how it's not you going to run away. I know your God. He's going to fly you away, kind of like Philip in the New Testament. Okay, can we grab the next picture? Right, so long story short, Elijah says to Ahab, well, you get all your priests. Let's have a dance-off. And he basically burninates them. All the villagers. He has all the prophets of Baal killed because their god can't actually do the burninating. And this is in front of all of Israel. They all gathered to see this. So God proves himself more powerful than Baal. The Israelites are on the verge of turning back to him. He must be the real God. Then Elijah gets down, says he puts his head between his knees and prays. And the drought stops. There's rain. The famine's over. So, you know, he's national hero. He's number one. He's going to be like the king's right-hand man. So this is obviously a massive high point for him. And then, let me just make sure I'm not going too far. Okay. And then Jezebel sends him a message saying, you know, by this time tomorrow I'm going to have you killed. I'm going to find you and I'm going to kill you. And Elijah basically just melts. He's at this absolute high point where he's calling down flames from heaven and he's killing false prophets and all the rest. And she says, I'm going to kill you. And he just completely melts. And his stomach drops. If you go to the next page, he realizes he's one of the last of the Jedi. That's for you, Stu, if you're here. He's one of the last of the prophets. And despite having displayed God's power, his stomach drops and he gets totally overcome by fear. All his confidence deserts him and he takes off for Beersheba. So if we grab the next picture. So he's come from there to tell the king off. And then from there he runs out of Israel into the land of Judah, which is outside of Jezebel's political reach. That's not good enough. He runs all the way down and he ends up here, which is almost as far as you can get without leaving Judah. And then that's not enough for him, actually. He then decides, no, I'm going to go for a day's walk into the desert to get even further away. So He's having real fear. And when he gets into the desert, he basically finds a tree. He crawls underneath it and he says, God, kill me. I've had enough. You know, this has all been for nothing. This has been a failure. He's probably filled with shame for the fact that he's run after God's proved himself to be, you know, to be real. And then he falls asleep. And this is the stuff I wanted to talk about, was how good our God is. He, instead of killing him, he sends an angel, wakes him up, and gives him food twice, and then says, you know, you need to eat more because I'm taking you to Mount Horeb, which is the very place where Moses saw God. You remember when he was put in the cleft in the rock? So Elijah gets up and he does a 30-day walk through the desert down towards Egypt to Mount Sinai, or, so forget the next picture, Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb, which they think that might be the one. And he ends up in a cave, I think most likely the cave where Moses met with God. God loves repeating stuff. And now God meets him, introduces himself to him. And now either Elijah is super familiar with God, because I mean, they did already talk, or he's actually in a really, really low place, because God sends the wind and it shatters rocks and it throws rocks, and he sends an earthquake and parts of the cave collapse, and there's fireballs shooting from the sky. And at the end of all of this, God says to him, why are you here? And Elijah's so raw with defeat that he says to God, if we grab the next page, he says, I've been very zealous for you, but the Israelites have rejected your covenant. They've torn down your altars. They've put your prophets to death with a sword. I am the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too. Now, if you remember the parallel with Moses, Moses sees God and he ends up glowing face, and they have to put a veil. Elijah doesn't get any of that. He's like, God, everything's been pointless. It's been worthless. You know, I think he says at one point, I'm no better than my ancestors. And I was reading this going, this is quite interesting when you contrast that with Moses. And I started to read some commentaries on it. And one commentary said that here we see Elijah completely missing it, where God has shown him his awesome power and he should have been awed, and instead he's looking inwards and being sorry for himself. And then I read the commentary by Matthew Henry, who's an old school commentator. And I really like what he had to say. And he said, actually, here's where we see God's gracious nature. Because instead of hurling one last fireball down in Elijah's direction and taking him out, he actually addresses all of Elijah's concerns. So I'll just paraphrase what God said. But basically he said, you know, after Elijah said, you know, that the Israelites are a bad lot, he basically says, look, I'm going to discipline them and bring them back to myself. And Elijah's saying, I'm the last one. And God says, you're not alone. There's 7,000 others who have not turned to Baal yet. And then, you know, he says that they're trying to kill me. I'm the only one left. God says, I'm going to give you Elisha, who's going to walk with you and he's going to serve you. And one day he'll take over from you so you can enter my rest, which is a paraphrase. So that was very, very fast way of going through it. But essentially, what I wanted to highlight was some of the highs and lows that he went through. It's obvious that God had called him. That God had told him what he wanted him to do. And then he had to walk through that. So he had years of sitting in the wilderness, years of sitting in a unclean house with a widow, you know, outside of his country. I guess what I wanted to say is that God has called you, if you're feeling this, and you may be on your way down to Beersheba at the moment, but you must know that God will meet with you and that he is actually sensitive to what you're going through. So he's not going to... He's not going to smite you if you feel like you failed on your calling to him. He actually knows what you're going through. So there we go. That's very short, mostly context-free little story.